Tea and Jeopardy with Emma Newman. There's always time for a nice cup of tea and a spot of mild peril. Well, hello there, my lovelies. I do hope you're well and haven't discovered that you're actually a clone created for the harvesting of your organs. My name is Emma Newman, and I'd like to welcome you into my secret tea lair for polite conversation, abject geekery, a cheeky bit of cake, and of course, a nice cup of tea. I hope you managed to find the mansion without too much trouble. It is rather tucked away on top of this hill, isn't it? It seems we're going to have a storm soon. It's been threatening all day here. I hope so. We should have a wonderful view of lightning over the surrounding countryside from this attic laboratory. It has such large windows. Do take a seat, but don't touch any of the apparatus on the tables around us. The chap who owns this mansion is a keen scientist, and warned me that many of these instruments are very delicate. Take no notice of the things in jars on the shelves over there. I'm sure they're not real fingers or limbs, and I can assure you that the rumours about my friend's research are entirely unfounded. He has only one pet, a small tabby cat called Bernard, and has never dabbled in anything that involves reanimating the dead.
I'm sorry to interrupt you, ma'am, but your guest has arrived. Mr. Michael R. Underwood.
Ah, oh, splendid. Let's see his calling card.
If I may be so bold, ma'am, I think in this case the R may stand for refined.
You sound impressed, Latimer.
He arrived exactly on time, is polite, well-dressed, and carried his sword in the proper fashion. More than that, I didn't even have to ask him to hand it over before taking tea. I do believe we have a proper gentleman as a guest this week.
A sword, eh? Ah, yes, there's one on his motif. It looks like a Spanish one, over a book. Very attractive. Michael R. Underwood, speculative fictionero, assorted geekdom, angry robot sales and marketing manager.
He sells angry robots?
No, Latimer, they're my publisher, Angry Robot Books.
But you don't write novels about
angry... Oh, show him in, Latimer. For those of you who don't know, Mike Underwood is the author of Geekomancy and the recently released Celebromancy. He is also one of the splendid people at Angry Robot who helps to sell my books to fine people with a passion for fiction that isn't afraid to cross genre boundaries.
Mr. Michael R. Underwood, ma'am.
Hello, Mike. Do come and sit down. How are you?
I'm doing well, and yourself?
I'm very well, thank you. Would you like some tea?
Certainly.
How do you take your tea?
Black, two sugars, please.
Black with two sugars. And to go with your tea, there's a very special treat that Latimer has made us. A hot fudge sundae a la Councillor Troy.
Oh, I do love a good sundae.
Excellent. Well, I shall just place it in front of you there with a long spoon for you to enjoy at the rate that you wish. So, I must say, Latimer was really quite impressed with you. I understand you brought a sword with you this evening.
Oh, well, I find that when a gentleman is traveling around on heavy slopes and through various villages of unknown provenance, that it helps to be armed.
I quite agree. When I extended an invitation to you, I invited you to bring a curio with you. I'm assuming the sword is not the curio, though.
No, it's a fairly regular talking piece. Instead, I decided to bring my official Angry Robot companion, which I procured from the fine vendors of Singularity and Company in Brooklyn. This is a small wooden robot painted red with gadgets and gears and a rather spiky sine curve-esque display for a mouth. And it's attached by a kind of springy strings so that the arms and legs and head are all poseable, which means that it can be a dancing robot, it can be a coming to get you a Dalek or a Cyberman robot. It's really quite versatile. I've taken this little guy as my official representation of my membership in Angry Robot.
Aw, it's very, very cute. I've heard that the Angry Robot office in Nottingham is full of little robots that have been gifted or acquired over the years. I'd love to see them one day.
Yeah, I think we should probably do a like a robot family album, like maybe sometime as a holiday card. Get the staff, and then more importantly, the entire array of little robot toys and gee-jaws out in front.
Yes, absolutely. One of the things that I wanted to talk to you about was a blog post you wrote a little while ago about the need for another Star Trek.
Indeed, I was quite passionate about it.
Yes, I felt quite stirred when I read it, I must admit. I was wondering if you would like to share the spirit of that post with the people who have joined us for tea.
Certainly. Well, the kind of the idea behind that post came out of my personal relationship with Star Trek, which started when I was quite young. I watched The Next Generation, pretty much the entire series, and I must have been between, I'd say, 5 and 11 or 12, however long it actually ran. And Star Trek Next Generation was really my foundational science fiction television. It taught me what the tropes that I should expect, common storytelling, tale types that Star Trek and therefore science fiction can give us, and really taught me that science fiction was a storytelling mode that you can use to explore social issues and to examine difference and to ask that also important question of what if. And as I was reflecting on the first of the rebooted films and kind of looking ahead to the second one and then reflecting on it after having seen it, I wanted to kind of write down what I thought the heart and the social use of Star Trek was, that mostly being the ability to project into the future with optimism, which we're not seeing a lot in science fiction literature or film or even TV right now. It's a lot of dystopia and cyberpunk and reflecting on all the things that could go terribly wrong, whereas I see Star Trek as, inspired by Gene Roddenberry's in original vision, a way of looking forward to the future and dreaming of how humanity might become better, how we might learn to put aside our differences and highlight the things that make us individually special to create a greater whole, and that a new Star Trek series would be a way to highlight diverse characters, not just ethnic diversity, cultural diversity, diversity in sexual orientation, in gender identity, in different types of ability, and that it's been a while since we've had a new Star Trek show, and the world has changed. And I think it would be a great time now to have a new ongoing show that tries to imagine what a 21st century version of an optimistic view of the future could be.
Mm, I couldn't agree more. That was such an important thing for me when I was in my young teens. I don't know whether there was like a delay before it was shown in the UK, so I don't know if we were watching it at the same time, but it was probably a very similar time. And it really was my substitute family, I've come to realise as I look back, because I was going through a very, very tumultuous time in my life. And it was so important to me to have something positive and something to aspire to. And this kind of message of people trying and striving to be the best they can be on a kind of organizational scale and a very personal scale as well. And you're right, I don't think that there is a lot of that out there these days, at least nothing that I've come across. And I love really dark, miserable sci-fi. I love that. I'm quite dark and miserable at times, and it really speaks to me. But I think that it is really important to have something like Star Trek to balance that as well.
Yeah, and I like that in Star Trek they frequently solve problems through diplomacy or through mutual understanding instead of just bigger and bigger and bigger explosions. They had the Marshall characters, and then some of the Marshall characters were also diplomats. And that their goal was to understand, not to conquer.
I must admit, I almost disappear in a puff of rage when people say, well, at least the new Star Trek films are bringing Star Trek to a new generation of people. And it's like, no, they're not. They're not. They're not bringing Star Trek, the essence of Star Trek, to a new group of viewers. They're just bringing another set of big woo-wah explosions and lens flare with different names of characters to a new group of people. I don't feel like Star Trek, the pure essence of Star Trek is being brought out in these films. But, that's me raging. I just have a little sip of my tea here.
Indeed.
It does make me grumpy. So, I think you've already answered the first question I wanted to ask you, which was, which Star Trek is your favourite? And you're a Next Generation gentleman. And, you know, I knew there's a reason we got on so well. So I'm a Next Generation as well. Do you subscribe to the theory that a person's favourite Trek is the one that they grew up watching?
I think that there's probably a fair bit to that. I maybe have seen one or two episodes of original series as I was growing up. And then I followed on watching Deep Space Nine and a bit of Voyager and only the tiniest bit of Enterprise. And I quite enjoyed Deep Space Nine, but that was, there's a big contrast between them in terms of one is optimistic and about exploration, and Deep Space Nine is more dark and political and gets into spirituality. And that I think if I had maybe been a little bit older when Deep Space Nine came on, if there had been a little bit more of a gap between them, that might have taken over as my favorite, because I'm a huge fan of Babylon 5, which is kind of its counterpart outside of the Trekverse.
Yeah, I missed the Babylon 5 train. I don't know what I was doing at the time. I wish I could go back in time and berate myself for not going to various Babylon 5 weekends that my friends held at the time to catch up. I don't know. I was probably role-playing or something, but I just didn't get to them, and too much of it went by before I could catch up. But I've heard so many good things about it.
It's the kind of show, I think, that gets better the more of it you've seen, which can be difficult right in the beginning, especially going back and looking at it now, because the CG is aging a bit and showing that time difference. But I've been rewatching it with my girlfriend, and it stands up quite well.
What about Battlestar Galactica?
I watched all of the remake kind of from the beginning after a little bit of a gap, not seeing the miniseries immediately. The thing about that is that it's so dark that it's actually less comfortable for me to go back and rewatch. So we watched a little bit together, and then I was like, I would rather watch something happier and shiny, because this is so drums and doom and they're all going to die.
Oh, I love the new Battlestar Galactica, and I resisted it for so long because I was just stupid, really. I just couldn't get my head around Starbuck being a girl. It just broke my brain on some level, because I could remember the reruns of the really old Battlestar Galactica, and I adored Starbuck in that when I was like five or six or whatever when it was on. And I just couldn't bear the thought of it. And so I resisted and resisted and then caved in, and we binged terribly on the box sets, which is, you know, I think a cornerstone of geek behavior, to just get the box set and watch, you know, really intensively. I can't bear week-long gaps between things now.
Well, I can bear it a little bit more if I have a social experience that goes along with it. If I know that every Saturday or Sunday or whatever, I'm going to be able to spend time with friends, and we'll talk about what's come before, and then we'll talk about the episode right after it happens. Then it turns the show into a part, like a centerpiece of a community, and that I can really get excited about.
Ah, those halcyon days before children, when we used to have such things as social viewing. Alas, those days are over for us. So it's been a long time since I've been able to watch things with friends. Yeah, I do miss that. What was, you know, we're talking here as proper geeks. I was wondering what your gateway drug into geekery was. Was it Next Gen that drew you into this beautiful world that we live in?
I think it might actually go farther back than that. I like to tell the story that my parents took me to see two movies before I was 1 year old. One was Gandhi, and the other one was Return of the Jedi. One of those has had a bit more of an effect on my life than the other. I watched Star Wars a lot as a very young kid, as well as The Princess Bride. And I think early films plus like Saturday morning cartoons, I never really had a chance to not be a geek. And it really kind of became a essential kind of identity facet when I started playing D&D, and then when I got into other gaming. And, you know, I'd go into a new school and it would be, can I find the gamers? And that's really how I got sorted into Geekendore as my house.
Fair enough. Yes, early Star Wars is critical. We had quite, you know, serious conversations about how old the Bean should be when we could first watch Star Wars with him, and obviously, you know, Chapter 4 and all of that kind of stuff. These are important issues. Interesting. So which is your favorite gaming system?
In terms of tabletop RPGs?
Yeah.
The one I'm really enjoying now is Fate Core, which is the several versions refined development of the Fudge system.
I haven't played with that. Tell me about that.
So the biggest cool part about the Fate system is the way that characters are built. Instead of having, you know, strength 15, dexterity 12, intelligence 17, and so on, your characters are mostly defined by aspects. And these are phrases or kind of materials that they have. So a main character would have a high concept, which kind of sums up who they are as a person. For Geekomancy and Celebromancy, my main character would be Snarky Novice Geekomancer as her high concept. And then characters have aspects which describe parts of who they are. So she might have other aspects that are like, I love my rhyming ladies, representing her friendship with kind of her three BFFs. Or something else like, you know, Jill of all geekdoms, that represents the range of the things that she loves. So you describe characters not through numbers, but in kind of descriptive characterization phrases. And then you have to invoke those in order to get bonuses and overcome challenges. So it's a great way of focusing on story through character.
Wow, that is really interesting. I haven't played with anything. Well, the only thing that I can think of that gets sort of close, but not really, is the Exalted system where you... Have you played Exalted?
I have. I've, in fact, run a couple games. I do love the cinematic aspect of it, and the stunt system is marvelous. Mm. I love that kind of system-based reward for strong description.
Yeah, and that was the first game I played, and probably actually the only game I played which had that aspect to it, which I thought was really great. It's particularly if you're playing with players who are wildly creative and incredibly talented people, and it's just like having, you know, like you say, a very cinematic experience, having people creating films in your head around you is a joyful thing. So are you running anything at the moment?
No, I found that the part of my brain that can run tabletop RPGs and the part of my brain that writes novels are the same.
Yeah.
So I've had to be very protective of my writing brain. And since we moved to Baltimore, I haven't found a gaming group, because I've made several connections who like to game, but none of them want to be the storyteller. So I'm either going to need to break down and figure out how to do both, or search a little bit more to try and find someone who will accept the role of the cloak and the mantle and the cowl and all the goodness.
I mean, the only way that I've found to, because I totally agree with you, they are the same bit of the brain. And the only thing that I've been able to do in the past is kind of world test by running a game set in the world that I'm currently brewing.
Right.
But then when it comes to the time when I want to just focus on writing the book, I have to stop GMing. Because, you know, with the medium being so different, there's only so much you can carry from one to the other, and then things change, and then suddenly it's like two versions of the same world, and, oh, calamity. So, yes, I totally understand. Before our time in the tea lair today, I asked on the Twitters, as I am wont to do, what they would like to ask you, should they have the opportunity. And one question... Well, there are two questions that leapt out. One was less serious, which was, are there actually any happy robots? Which I liked. Are there any happy robots in Angry Robot, or are they all angry?
Well, I think actually all of us are occasionally happy, and we tend to really enjoy our jobs. We have a new publicity manager, Caroline, and she's very cheery. But until she came on, I kind of unofficially had claimed in my brain the role of the happiest of the angry robots. So we are happy at times. We're especially happy when we get to sign new authors, or when books come out and we get to be really excited and run up and down the halls of the internet screaming about how cool our authors are. So there's quite a lot to be happy about.
Which leads me very nicely into the question from Twitter that I wanted to ask you, which is, what's the most fun you've had marketing an angry robot book?
Well, I very recently had a great experience at Word Bookstore in Brooklyn, where we had Mr. Chuck Wendig and T.L. Costa came in to do an event, and kind of I took on the role of the MC and asked them questions and fielded questions from the audience. And we had a great time, a marvelous turnout. They totally filled the event space that they have in the basement and sold a good number of books. And we got to chat with the booksellers, and that kind of in-person experience is probably one of the most rewarding for me, because I used to be a traveling book rep, and it was all about being in the bookstores. And I love seeing writers be able to make connections with readers and fans.
And that's one of the things that I enjoy most about being an author as well, is connecting to people who love the books and things. There is no happier, squishier feeling inside, as you well know yourself.
It is really nice.
My last question for you today, thinking of the rather beautiful sword that you brought with you, which reminds me of Will's sword on the cover of Any Other Name. Have you noticed the sword on the cover of the second Split Worlds book?
Yeah, that looks to me like a late 15th century swept hilt rapier, which was a fairly dominant design for a while before the blacksmithing technology got to the point where solid plates were able to be attached to the guards and become more substantial, like the later Mangouche.
I just think they're so beautiful. I love swords. Anyway, I wanted to ask you, out of all of the real and fictional swordsmen and women there have been over the years, who would you most like to duel and why?
Ooh, that's a very nice question. First, I'm gonna take the assumption that it's friendly dueling, because then I can have more fun.
Oh, yes, friendly dueling, definitely. Not to the death, because that would just be sad.
I think in that case, I would probably want to have a friendly duel with Don Luis Pacheco, whose full name is extensive because he's Spanish. He was the second of the Spanish masters in the style called La Verdadera Destreza, which is the true path or the true fencing, because he took the system that came before, learned from his master Carranza, and then codified the system, made everybody else retest by his rules, and was an incredible writer in terms of smack talk, like early 17th century smack talk from one fencing master to the other. So I get the sense that Pacheco was a great kind of wit with a sharp tongue and a sharp blade, and that he backed up his fencing foo with being rather sassy, and that would probably make for a fun duel and a chat.
He sounds cool.
He was.
I understand that you've had a book that's just come out yourself.
Indeed.
Because you have two hats. You have your author hat and your marketing and angry robot hat. So if I may be so bold as to ask you to change hats briefly.
All right.
To talk about your author stuff.
Mm-hmm.
Because I understand Celebromancy has come out. That's a sequel to Geekomancy. That's right, isn't it?
Yes, just actually at the start of last week. So Celebromancy is nice, I think, for a lot of readers because it will stand alone if you haven't read the first book. So you can just dive right into the new one.
Ah, that's much more clever than I do with mine. I have to have people start at the beginning. So, well, I can't do that. That's a much better way of doing things. So tell me a little bit about Celebromancy, because it's a female lead character.
Yes, so the lead is Rhiannon Ana Maria Reyes, who goes by Ri, because she's Puerto Rican and Irish, so she has a ridiculous conglomeration of names, because that was fun. She is what is known as a geekomancer. So through her personal connection to pop culture that she loves, she's able to do amazing things. The biggest, most fun to write and then to use form of geekomancy is genre emulation. So she can watch a movie or TV show that she loves, and then by making a connection to a character and the film, do amazing, magically impossible things. So she can watch The Matrix and then do awesome wire foo, or she can watch Star Wars and then use the Force. And then geekomancy also extends to using props, like picking up a phaser from Star Trek The Next Generation, of which she is also a fan, as well as us, and using the phaser as a real phaser. And then the third style is more kind of ritual. And with that, you could take collectible cards or comics or some kind of artifact of geek culture and then tear it up in order to produce a one-shot effect. So that's much more like kind of a potion style. So tear up a Magic the Gathering card and then shoot the spell or summon the creature. And then she reuses all these different powers to kind of protect the city that she lives in, which becomes very important because the story of Celebromancy is reselling a pilot script to a production company. So she's launching her career as a screenwriter, except that the main actress, Jane Conrad, has been struck by a celebromantic curse. So celebromancy is the magic of fame and celebrity. So Rhee has to use her own magic skills to investigate and try and stop this curse, because the way that the curse works, every time Jane uses her magic powers to be an incredible performer, there's a building backlash and kind of hangover from it, which will eventually threaten her life. So Rhee has to balance her personal life and her professional life as a screenwriter, using her geek passion powered magic to fight crime, crack wise, and save the day.
I want to be a geekomancer. That sounds so cool. And I think I'd be a really good geekomancer.
I think you would. You know, being a part-time time lord, I think, puts you pretty high up into the geekomancer class levels.
Do you have to be a certain age before you start manifesting geekomancy skills? Because I'm thinking about my six-year-old Beanie, who would be quite terrifying if it manifested that young.
I don't have any very young geekomancers. I tried to keep to the same kind of model that I see in a lot of other fantasy fiction, where magical power tends to develop a little bit later in life. You know, some with like Harry Potter, you get early teens and preteen, and sometimes it's a little bit later on. And I had it set up so that Rhee didn't discover that she had the power because she didn't believe that she could. So that she had the geekdom and the potential, but there was a part of her brain's like, people can't do magic. I love this stuff, but people clearly can't do magic, until kind of her worldview is jostled enough that her powers unlock.
Oh, wow. I really want that now.
You and me.
Yes. Is there an element of wish fulfillment in these books that you've written?
Only a huge heaping handful.
Hooray. I think that's where some of the best books come from. When the writer really wants it themselves and puts all of their passion into it, definitely. Excellent. That's in ebook, isn't it? I can't buy paperback versions. It's ebook only, isn't it?
Not at the moment. So there's ebook and then audiobook for both books.
Ah, cool. Audiobook as well. Excellent. Oh, yes, isn't Mary Robinette Quarle just done? Has she done Celebromancy and Geekomancy?
Just Celebromancy.
Oh, she has got such a fabulous voice.
Yes, I won the narrator lottery when we were able to get her.
Yes, you really did. She's just got the most gorgeous voice ever, and so does her dad.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, he's got a very, very lovely voice as well. So, yes, you won. I think the only other geek narrator that could possibly trump Mary might be Will Wheaton.
Could be, and Will narrated Ready Player One.
Ah, I've heard many good things about Ready Player One. I haven't got around to reading that yet.
Well, if you like the kind of geek culture references in Geekomancy and Celebromancy, chances are you'll also like Ready Player One. It focuses more on the 80s pop culture references, so it's very kind of Gen X specific in some ways, mm-hmm. But then also brings in a whole lot of video gaming kinds of stuff with like Second Life to the nth degree.
Excellent. I will have to, oh dear, more books.
Right?
That's the trouble, isn't it? There's so many books to read and so little time. What a wonderful dilemma to have. Well, let me just check the teapot. Yes, I'm afraid the teapot is empty. And, oh dear, it does look rather dark and stormy out there. I do hope you'll be all right going back down the hill. But Latimer will be able to give you your sword back, of course. He'll give your sword back before you leave. So should anything leap out of the bushes at you, you'll be able to defend yourself. Though there have been rumours of some kind of creature in the woods nearby, but I wouldn't pay any mind. I think it's all just local gossip gone too far.
Oh, well, everyone has their own folklore. It's quite fine. We just have to figure out ways of dealing with the things in the dark, and we may come up with stories, and hopefully it's all just, you know, some random, I don't know, coyote. Maybe you don't have coyotes up here in this country.
No, not in these parts. Though there are lots of stories of like the Bodmin Moor beast and things, which sometimes pictures appear and they look a bit like a panther that okay. might have escaped. I love all that kind of folklore, though. It makes for a richer experience. But anyway, I mustn't keep you any longer. You have a book to launch and other people's books to talk up and all kinds of things. You must be horrendously busy. So don't let me keep you a moment longer.
Thank you so much for your hospitality. It's been great to be here. The tea was marvelous, and the sundae was just the perfect kind of dessert for a gloomy bit of weather. warm my heart and my stomach.
I'm very pleased to hear it. It's been an absolute pleasure to have you here, and I shall see you again very soon, I hope.
Yes, thank you, and we'll be doing more to promote the Split Worlds across the internets and all dimensions between.
Excellent. Well, I'll see you in San Antonio, I imagine.
Yes, there will be more Team Robot plotting.
Yay! I will see you at Worldcon then.
Until then.
Until then, take care. Bye!
Cheers.
Your sword, sir. I'm sorry, the weather is so inclement.
Oh dear, the storm's getting worse. And what are those lights coming up the hill? There's an awful lot of them.
It would appear the local villagers are here, Mum, and they seem most upset.
Are they carrying pitchforks? Do people still do that these days?
It appears so, Mum.
Oh, they're waving them at Mike. They're attacking him!
Marvellous!
Marvellous?
Yes, Mum. Now we'll get a chance to see the gentleman's swordplay in action. Ah, there he goes.
He's very good.
I do believe he's employing Bonetti's defense, Mum, with, as a friend of mine would say, rather leet skills. And those dirty peasants won't stand a chance against Toledo Steel.
Dirty peasants? How rude. Oh, they've stopped fighting. They want to see his hands. How strange.
Ah, yes. They've mistaken him for the scientist who uses the laboratory. He's known to have terribly scarred hands. Acid burns, I believe.
They seem very impressed with Mike's hands, particularly the state of his nails.
Ah, the sign of a true gentleman. It's all in the cuticles, Mum.
Well, that all seems to have worked out in the end. I wonder if that's why my friend was so happy for us to use the laboratory tonight.
I fear so, Mum. Shall I release the diastote?
No, too obvious.
Very good, Mum. Should I sabotage one of the experiments to express your displeasure?
I would never stoop so low as to interfere with the pursuit of science. I am rather upset, though. Strike his name from the Christmas card list, Latimer. And make sure that he doesn't receive an invite to the secret party.
A fitting punishment, Mum. I shall see to it at once.
I'm sure the rest of Mike's journey will be uneventful, and even if it isn't, at least he can defend himself. Well, dear guests, thank you for joining the deliciously geeky Mike Underwood and I today. The next time we take tea together, we'll be joined by Lauren Bucas, should her schedule permit a brief visit to the tea there. Last week, I asked for advice on what to serve as a dessert at a dinner party, with a member of the undead amongst the guests. I'd like to raise my teacup to Paul, who suggested sugar candy skulls from the Mexican festival Dia de los Muertos. Apparently, they are the favoured treat of the undead on the other side of the Atlantic, presenting a pleasantly exotic solution, which will no doubt spark some delightful conversation. Thank you, Paul. In a few weeks, I'll be travelling to San Antonio in Texas to attend Worldcon. On the Thursday night, I'll have the pleasure of hosting a room party with several author friends, and I would so love to see you there. In my efforts to be the consummate hostess, could you be dears and tell me what would make it the perfect party for you? I'm afraid I can't promise cake, as Latimer will be taking a well-deserved holiday, but all suggestions are welcome, particularly the outlandish and comedic, as long as they're within the realms of common decency. Do be dears, and leave your answers at www.teaandjeopardy.com. I'll pick the best one and share it with you the next time we take tea. If at all possible, I will add it to the party plans. Well, until next time, my sugared almonds. Now, Latimer, find a new location for the secret tea there, would you? Perhaps somewhere with fewer locals.
Very good, Mum.
You've just listened to an episode of Tea and Jeopardy, hosted by Emma Newman. Go to www.teaandjeopardy.com To find out more and join in.